I'm Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. I'm sitting in Athens, Georgia, just turned off some Cannonball Adderley. It's Monday. Masters now over. Go Tiger. No matter what you think of the man, he's an amazing golfer, and that was an amazing emotional response and finish to an amazing Masters, where I cooked all week, actually. But now I'm back, and on today's show, I visit a 24-seat restaurant in New York called Gem and sit down with its very young chef, Flynn McGarry. Flynn's 20 years old. He's been cooking professionally for half of his life. And put that in perspective with mind math, that means he's been cooking since he was 10 years old. Flynn is the subject of a new documentary available on Hulu called Chef Flynn. And he is an amazingly interesting man. And he's not a kid. He's a professional chef, and he does it with the aplomb that anyone thinks that any professional chef would. He has fought against this pitted idea of him being some child outside of his realm for most of his life, but I think that he's just more mature than, well, me and most people. So it's a great chat. And it's a really interesting chat about chefdom in New York and the fights that we fight every day in the world of food. It's a good fight. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it. Write a review on your podcast app. That will help other people find the show. And if this is your first time listening, please subscribe and check out other episodes like Alex Stupak Explains Tacos. And last week's episode, Ruth Reichel is a Plum. Which is a great episode. You should listen to that one. Here's this week's conversation. Flynn McGarry makes a movie. It's a little chilly outside, but I'm in the Lower East Side of Manhattan on Forsyth Street at a restaurant that's very new. And it's run by Flynn McGarry, who is a very interesting... Everybody is always going to say young. He's just a human who... embarked on a genuine and authentic interest in food at quite a young age, and it was well documented in that way. Vogue, and Flynn's right in front of me, so I'm just talking about him like he's not here, but he is here.
Used to it.
Yeah, that's okay. And then, yeah, Vogue said you were the Justin Bieber of food, which made me want to barf. Yeah, I mean, you're very cute, but you're not Canadian, man. You're not. He's Canadian, though. I'm Canadian.
All the tattoos.
So we've given away Justin Bieber, actually, a long time ago. We keep Alex Trebek, but Justin Bieber had to go.
He's like a person of the world, I feel like.
Yes, I think, yeah. I'm not sure he's of this world. But Flynn, you were really known as growing up very inclined to want to be a chef at a really young age, which I found really interesting. You know, I worked in a lot of kitchens when I was like 14, 15, and they're really good restaurants, but not like the ones you were in. They're very old school and French. But I mean, at 15, where were you?
At 15.
You were in LA.
I was in LA. I was working in a restaurant called Alma.
Okay. With another very young chef.
Another very young chef, which is sort of how we...
What was his name?
Ari Tamor.
Ari Tamor, yeah.
And I started working there when I was 14. Worked there for a couple of years, and that was sort of, I mean, I would go do pop-ups and go intern in other restaurants, but that was sort of like my home base for a restaurant for a while.
What's Ari doing now?
Ari has a new restaurant in LA.
Okay.
It's called Little Prince. It's in Santa Monica now.
Okay.
So still small, kind of very different.
He's very talented, but the food you guys were doing in Alma was really good. I remember eating there once. And that stretch of Broadway has just suddenly exploded.
Yeah. And I mean, and
it was kind of before its time in a lot of way in the nascency of downtown LA.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what really kind of, I went there for dinner one time with a friend who was friends with Ari and remember sort of, it was a time in LA where like I was really interested in these sort of like going to work at 11 Madison Park, going to work at all these other restaurants. And I was looking at LA as far as like, I lived in LA. So I had, if I wanted to work somewhere like, long term, I had to work somewhere in LA, and I just couldn't quite find a restaurant that I thought really fit what I was interested in food wise. And went to Alma, and it was sort of this like really kind of thing where I just felt this energy of like a bunch of really young people in a space that wasn't really established, a neighborhood that wasn't super expensive, and didn't really have everything on their side of, like, I went in the summer and there was no air conditioning. And,
right.
But it was that was sort of what was charming about it.
There was the good fight was happening.
Yeah.
At Alma.
Exactly. And I mean, I see that a lot in sort of what
we're what you're doing right now. We'll talk about that, definitely.
But that was sort of what attracted me to it, was it was like a very just a group of very passionate people who didn't really want to, like, conform to what everyone wanted in the LA food scene or whatever, and even how they moved to doing a tasting menu and sort of had this sort of kind of constant drive. And that's where, I mean, I worked all the stations there and was sort of like the tournant at the end, and just sort of like got to the place in that restaurant where I really learned how to run a station by myself,
right,
learned how to do ordering and learned how to expedite and all those things. And at the same time as that, I was sort of also doing, like, once a month I would do a little pop-up at a different restaurant in LA. But even I think sort of around 15, pulled that back a little bit just mm-hmm. because of the sort of craziness that goes into doing that. And I was sort of focusing, I mean, that time there's a big New York Times piece on me. And sort of once that came out, sort of pulled back a lot.
Right.
I did a dinner. I sort of right when it came out, I went to New York for the first time to do a dinner. That did not go well. Sort of was the...
We all have those marks in our careers.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm glad it happened. I mean, like, it didn't go well in the way of, like, no one...
It wasn't a disaster.
Yeah, and, like, in hindsight, it's sort of like, it was just a bad night of service. And, like, but it was this thing where I mean, sort of realized in that moment of, like, we essentially came to do, it was like two nights, 50 people a night with a 10-course menu. And I had an entire staff, we did it out of this, like, catering space. So an entire staff of catering cooks, catering waiters, who mm-hmm. notoriously, it's a job for them.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the first time that I saw, like, the reach. Like, I was like, oh, I can't do this. Like, I'm not ready for this.
Well, pop-ups and temporary dinners, the one thing they do is they lack what we can do in leadership, which is cultivating craft throughout some time.
Yeah.
But when you're dropped into that scenario, it's like, you have what you have.
Yeah. It's like, you have a few days to organize this. And then, but also it was a time where it was so insanely hyped up where there's all of, I mean, it's just like, it was a, in hindsight, I was like, that was an awful idea.
It was a recipe for disaster,
but
wasn't it?
Yeah. Learned so much from it. And sort of, so after that, just kind of pulled back entirely. And I was like, I'm going to, like, not put myself, like, those were the opportunities that were around. Were, like, big dinners, whatever. And I was like, I don't want to do any of those. I'm good, like, just working. And that was the time also where I was sort of deciding, I was finishing, like, almost done with high school that I was doing online. And I was almost done with it. So I was like, what do I want to do when I finish? Because that was the only thing really holding me in LA. So I decided to just sort of work and save up money. And then when I was 16, I moved to Oslo to work at a restaurant, Mimo.
Yep.
And then went to Copenhagen to work at a restaurant, Geranium.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of spent sort of 5-month period just traveling around Europe by myself.
And then you moved to New York after that?
And then I moved to New York after that, yeah.
So Jem is... now just under a year old.
Yeah.
In the interim up to Jem from when you moved to New York, what were you doing?
So after that big pop-up, I decided the only way I would do pop-ups after were if it was in a scenario where I could do everything. Because I was like, there's no way for a small time period I'm going to be able to train a staff or even hire a staff because we're doing it a couple days a week, whatever we couldn't.
And retain a staff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was like, I only wanted to do pop-ups that would work where it was me, one person in the front of house, and a dishwasher. And so
how many people were you seating a night in that one?
We were doing 24 people a night.
And you were doing all of that? How many courses?
It was 12 courses.
Wow.
And we are now doing 24 people a night, roughly.
Yeah, but now you have a...
Now we have a staff.
You have people back there.
We have people back there. It's crazy.
You're a boss now.
And I mean, it was a very different setup than like what we do now. It was very focused on, I mean, it was treated a little bit more like it was always a counter.
Mm-hmm.
I served most of the dishes.
From the counter.
From the, I mean, it was literally counter, me cooking,
yep.
person next to me pouring yep. wine, pouring water, and we would just do everything. It was very just sort of streamlined. It, like, at that time, because I think a lot of it of, like, we were fitting in other people's spaces, it was very focused on, like, just the food. Mm-hmm. We would try to change the decor, try to change whatever to fit with what we were doing, but you can't.
It wasn't the big
There's no control over it.
Yeah.
So it was really like, how can we just strip everything down? And it's a counter, me and one person making food. And so I moved to New York and essentially did two different six-month pop-ups throughout the, I think, 3 years before whatever. And then in between that would do private events, whatever. Still kept traveling a bunch was something I really wanted to do was like, I would do a 6-month pop-up, work 7 days a week essentially for it. And then take 2 months and go to Italy or took over a hotel restaurant in Taiwan for a few weeks. And so that was the time where I was still wanting to travel.
Mm-hmm.
Being an American citizen, I can only go to Europe for certain periods. So I sort of split it up where I would go travel, come back, work really hard doing a pop-up and then learn a bunch from it. And then, but I mean, a lot of it was really just, I wanted to find how to cook in New York, find people in New York that trust, like for investors and mm-hmm. create relationships with farmers and sort of all of these relationships that you need when you open a restaurant. I wanted them to already be somewhat cultivated before.
Yeah. Setting up those relationships takes time. It's like, you don't just open the door.
Yeah, exactly.
LA and expect those relationships yeah. to be there. I'm trying to think of in LA around that time of Alma, what was really interesting to me. I mean, I think Chris Knighton Market was doing yeah. really interesting things. Jessica Kozel at Squirrel, I think, was really leading a movement. But now, I mean, geez, in the 4 years you've been away from, 5 years, 4.5 years or whatever, being away from L.A., the L.A. dining scene has completely changed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's completely metamorphosized into something that's pretty amazing right now. It's strong, and they're really not big into pomp and circumstance restaurants anymore, and they're really not into super high-end dining, which is interesting. Sushi is the one super high-end yeah, dining.
That's always a constant.
Yeah, in L.A.
But I mean, and that's even kind of why I left L.A. was I love the dining scene in L.A. I mean, I think I've probably eaten at Squirrel more than
right.
anyone else.
Yeah.
And I love all the restaurants there, and I love going back to it. But there were so many things that I kept getting frustrated with by doing these pop-ups and working in restaurants in the dining scene in L.A. where, like, there's something that, like, I love about sort of the element of service and the element of spending the whole night in a restaurant.
Right.
And those things just aren't really synonymous with L.A. restaurants.
No, they're not.
No. And, like,
They're not into the theater of dining.
Exactly.
The precision of fine dining.
And I love that. And I think that's sort of where we wanted to be a sort of special case where it's like we take inspiration from New York dining that way, but also like from most of the staff here, honestly, is from Southern California.
Right.
And so it's like having that like ingrained in you where it's like everywhere you worked in LA, ate in LA, didn't have any of that sort of art of the service and all this showmanship, whatever. It was just very like, we're not going
to
do that. Like, we're just going to, like, serve you
food.
We don't
need to.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the, in a lot of ways, what moved California cuisine was, you know, Wolfgang opening up Spago and saying, everybody, no more toques in the kitchen and you're all wearing baseball hats.
Yeah.
And sort of that sort of loosening that now, 30 years later, 35 years later, the idea of real, pure, beautiful service is now in vogue again, you know.
Yeah.
And but it still hasn't caught on again in LA. It's funny. That's funny. So at 20, you opened Gem, and I mean, I wasn't 20 when I opened up my first restaurant. I was 26, and I opened it up with like a shoestring budget. And in scouring your Instagram, not stalking, just scouring.
Just scouring.
It's nice.
Yeah.
It's clean. And I just noticed a lot of like some stuff of like fixing stuff and plumbing. And, you know, I remember doing crazy, I mean, I would go in to 5 and 10 when I first opened it and clean the bathrooms and do payroll and do the accounting from the night before. And that was at 9 till 10:30. And then I would go in the kitchen and start butchery and sauce work and soups and whatever we're doing. And then the staff would start coming in around 12:30, and we would get them. I would line them up for their chores. I also did the wine program. I mean, it seems like you're in a similar boat in a small restaurant where it's like you're wearing a lot of hats.
Yeah. I mean, that was what I sort of wanted to do was.
I love that part of it.
Well, I mean, and I, even with the investors or whatever, I know that that's not a sustainable way to do things for a long term.
It's not poised for growth.
Exactly.
Let's put it that way.
But there is something to be said about, like, within the first year or two of the restaurant where you're defining what the restaurant is, I think there, if you look at, I mean, the trend of restaurants, especially in New York, I think, mostly, and how it's becoming sort of overrun with restaurants that are opened by developers mm-hmm. and management deals and all of this stuff, and there's no singular point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And I designed the restaurant. I worked on all the contracts for the investment structure, the business structure, went to the building department myself. I wanted to learn every single inch of it and be a part of every single inch of it, because that's also just how I am personally. I don't like when there's things that I can't sort of
understand. Yeah.
And I mean, we built the whole restaurant in 3.5 months, mostly because I was the one scheduling the restaurant, like, build out, and all of the contractors and engineers and everything did not like how I was scheduling it, because I was like, why can't everyone just work at the exact same time? Like in a kitchen where people are setting up the dining room.
Because they don't like sharing extension cords.
No, exactly. But it was this thing where, like, I thought of everything the way I think of, like, just running the actual restaurant.
Doing it, yeah.
And this sort of real deadlines where I was like, I'm going to be open by this day.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, we will be open by this day, whether or not I have to put up half these walls in the restaurant myself. Just what I ended up doing. Like, and demolished the old space. Like, wanted to, from the day we got the space and then every day on, be involved in every single element in it. And I mean, obviously, as we opened, we, like, not even because I didn't want to do it, but like the wine program, I knew I was never going to do. And like right now, Daryl, who's in the other room, does our wine program and is incredible in it. But it took a while to find people, which I knew, that have similar ways of thinking of wine and of all these things as me. And, like, we opened with a wine director and who had what he was doing was great for him, but it didn't fit with us.
Yeah.
And I knew that was going to evolve and change, and that's part of it.
It's all fitting into the simpatico of what you want and what you're projecting. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It doesn't mean that that person's not good at their job.
Exactly.
It just means that they're not the right fit.
Yeah.
For it. And it's, you know, when you talk about a fit in a very small restaurant, everybody's got to fit.
Yeah.
Everybody's got to have their place.
True.
And you've got to, it's got to be a very a respective equanimity, or it just doesn't work. It's too small a space to have people
literally too small
working in the wrong in different ways. So back in the day, you cooked through Keller's book, French Laundry book. I think you were like one of three people actually cooked every single one of those recipes. Most of us as chefs just sort of atomized from them and borrowed it, and then the really horrible chefs just completely ripped off, you know, like oysters and pearls and stuff like that. Any recipe that just didn't work?
What was interesting about that book was, which I sort of recently, my mom just sent me out all my cookbooks. She was like, I don't want any of these. And started
and
going back.
Taking up like two rooms in the house.
Yeah, and I started going back through them though, and I noticed like the pages that had the most notes or the pages that had food on them even, I would always go to the back of the book for all those books, because as all these, the fine dining restaurant cookbooks that you can't cook any of those dishes. I even knew that most of these dishes, I was like, I'm cooking and I can't make these things. I went to the back and I was like, how does the French Laundry make a chicken stock? And like, that's what I was.
The back core recipe pages were some of the most foundational of all the menus I've ever written.
And I mean, that is how I learned how to cook was, and at a higher level, because like I learned to make stocks with ice cubes
yep.
before even knowing how to make what a chicken stock was.
Yeah.
And that was the thing where I always had the obsession with the highest level of doing everything. So I was like, I even want to learn the basics through a 3-Michelin-star restaurant. And I mean, there were certain dishes. I remember I had a really hard time making cornets.
Cornets, the French lingerie are famous for their salmon tartare and a little, it looks like an ice cream cone of salmon tartare.
And then, but it was the funny, I could never get it quite right. And then that was one of the times though where I was like, why isn't this happening right? It was always different. And I was like, oh, I don't have a convection oven that is like needed to make sure that it's all perfectly the same consistency when you pull out of the oven so it can be rolled nicely and not chewy on one part, yep. crunchy on the other part. Yep. And so that's where I also was like the Alinea book and all these books that were so out there, but I was using it to learn about the most basic, like what is a fluid gel and how to set these things and ratios. And I remember the...
Have you moved away from the use of a lot of those ingredients though? Because I think that's really, in the last 4 or 5 years, we saw the sort of apex of use of chemical compounds to, you know, whatever, spherify or, you know, to make fluid gels and things like that. Now it's really tapered off.
We use it in a way that is helpful.
Right, like we use but not predominant.
Xanthan gum and...
Xanthan gum is so weird, though.
We use the tiniest bit of it when it's...
Have you ever, by mistake, eaten some of it?
Oh, it's the...
It's weird.
You get it on your hands and
it's
just...
Oh, it's weird.
Yeah, you can't get it off. But like...
Like, if it touches your lungs, I'm like, what is it doing down there?
That thing, it is a mystery to me what even it is.
Yeah.
But like, it's been a thing where I think a lot of these ingredients, the only way that they're useful to us is when, for example, we want to make a sauce that has the texture of a meat sauce.
Without
any
a
meat.
A huge amount
and
of
And so we use a little
stock.
Bit of Ultratex. Yeah. And like... Yeah. In very sparing ways that aren't flashy in any way, or where there's no caviar beads or things like
You're
that.
You're not meat gluing a scallop
exactly.
to a chicken's head.
It's how can we use them to sort of get the cleanest flavor possible.
And I think that's the best use of those skill sets and techniques is not letting them overpower food, but let them advance food that isn't has a traditional footprint already.
Yeah. I mean, I learned that mostly because I went and I did a stage at Alinea. And when I was there... It was that thing where I idolized the book in that restaurant because it's such an iconic restaurant. And I went in that kitchen and I was like, oh, I don't actually like cooking like this. And it was such a big moment where I was just like...
I don't think he likes cooking like that anymore either.
No, I mean...
He's changed his style.
Yeah, exactly. But it was like, I saw like, they have all the equipment, they all the fancy stuff. And I was just like, I'm not cooking, I'm just weighing.
Yeah.
Like I just weighed things out all day.
Yeah.
And...
You don't have a roto evaporator back there?
But I mean, there are certain, and that was like what was really interesting about why I went to work at Geranium was I worked at MIMO, and so I was like, okay, do I go to Noma? And I like knew some of the guys and hung out with them a bunch when I was in Copenhagen, and I was like, I want to go to something that's such a different style.
Mm-hmm.
Which Geranium is the, like, I don't still even understand really how, like, we cook like that. And that was one of the first. Like the place that I saw that was like using it in this way that was just to make all the techniques really well and not in a showy way. Like they'd use them here and there and there's a lot of gels or whatever, but it was done to show the clarity of the ingredients.
Yep.
And
I think that's the maturation of the whole process with all those techniques and those ingredients is they need to progress us. They don't need to become sort of, crutches.
Yeah. I mean, I also think of that in the same way of like luxury ingredients
mm-hmm.
where it's like, I've never understood the need of adding truffles or adding caviar to something that it's just a habit. I've always thought they should be used in a way that's purposeful in the dish.
Yeah.
Where it's like the best caviar courses I've had aren't even like caviar courses. They're things where they use it for the salinity of it and the texture to make the dish something else. Or when truffles aren't just like, we're just going to put them on everything because they taste good. It's like a flavor component in the dish.
But and those were the sort of hallmark crutches of fine dining before. But that's changed a lot in the last 20 years even for a number of different reasons, but mostly because those things have become cost prohibitive to put across. So, you know, I talk about the food progress a lot in fine dining menus, and it's funny that, you know, now we can charge, you know, $18 for a carrot salad, and you would have been laughed at 25 years ago in continental fine dining if you tried to do that. It just wouldn't make any sense. So, so the running of the restaurant day to day, you guys are open how many days a week?
5 days.
5 days. And is that feasible in New York, just being open for dinner? We'll see.
We'll see.
I think so.
I mean, the funny thing about being an expensive small restaurant is you're literally just shrinking your margin down to the smallest thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, our profit margin is plus or minus one guest, essentially. And I, like, literally after our first year, I have defined that that is our profit margin, which is such an insane thing to think about, that it's that fine of a balance. And I mean, it gives you, when you really look at it, it's like, okay, great. We don't have, like, we break even serving like 20 people a night, which is rare for most restaurants to say in New York. But it's also a thing where it's like our capacity is not significantly more than that. And I think it's where, I mean, we got really lucky with our rent situation and our sort of deal. But it, I think the trickiest thing for a restaurant like ours is we're not a restaurant you go every night. And we're not trying to be a restaurant you go every night.
Right.
And so it's how, it really is based on how you get that one extra person to come in every night and keep refreshing itself and keeping people interested in coming to dinner. And I think it's like a really tricky balance. We've seen, honestly, like trying to do more and more and more, especially now, doesn't work financially, because the thing that kills you in fine dining, as everyone knows, is labor. And like, it is such a hard thing to go by, because like,
well, it's the only thing you really can, I mean, there, you can control cost of goods.
Yeah.
You can't control, you know, that your nut of what your rent and your utilities are. You can control labor a little bit, but if you try and control labor too much, you'll never have staff retention. You'll never have a well-led troop of people doing good work.
Yeah, and even also like the attention, like the level of service you need to provide at this
there
level.
There is a minimum there.
There's a minimum. Yeah. And it's like, and I've had so many difficult conversations with just businessmen about this, where I'm like, we can't on a slow night cut our front of house staff.
Right.
Because regardless if we're serving 6 people or 12 people, there's the same mise en place needs to go and everything. There's the same attention that needs to be given to every guest. And it's a very hard thing to balance, especially when you're like, I think the reason that we kept shrinking was it was like, we, this table, like the table of six, we sort of do in a way that's like, you kind of book it when we, like, you have to email, whatever. But there'd be weeks where, especially when we first opened, where on a Friday, Saturday, we would do 36 covers.
Mm-hmm.
And on like a Tuesday, Wednesday, we would do 20. And that is almost half. But I can't go to the staff, oh, we don't need half of you for the first half of the week.
Right.
They're all going to leave.
Yeah.
And even now, I mean, New York just raised minimum wage, minimum salary, raised everything. And so, I mean, it's, I think, I'm interested to see where the fine dining level of restaurants are going to go in New York, because it's just, the answer is just,
it really whittles down to what's tenable in this environment of a restaurant. It's like, you talk to any business person and they're going to be like, I don't understand the restaurant business.
Yeah.
And they won't, because our primary motivation in the 1% of restaurants who try to attain greatness and do really good work and present great food and great hospitality is we don't make much money. And we never will. I mean, I'm glad Kenneth Starr and people like that have figured it out, but I've never figured it out in 30 years of doing it. But
I mean, you see, and it's something that I've always really, that's been great, is like when, as a small restaurant, who you look at all these struggles and you look at all these, like, we're not going to make money, and it's such a hard thing to do, and then you talk to the people at the top and they're in the same boat. And you're like, this is such a nice feeling.
Yeah, to know, like, that we're all not making money.
Yeah,
it's refreshing.
I read it was like Rene Redzepi's last book that was like the 3-volume thing.
Right.
And it actually took me a really long time until the restaurant opened, but I actually read the journal that he did that was like a whole year. And I was like, it's crazy that like, it was like they got number one in the world. And then the next day he got a phone call from his accountant being like, we, as of February, won't be able to pay anyone. We'll have to close. And it's like, that's just the reality of a small, like, unless we had, were in a development or whatever, had all these outside backers and all this stuff, like trying to be a restaurant that we're focused on having the freedom to be creative and do whatever we want creatively comes with a lot of financial instability.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not going to go away in a area of rising rent.
And it's just that, yeah, it's a day-to-day struggle. And it's like, well, I mean, it's a lot of weighing the positives and the negatives, because like, I've said this, like, in a different life, I definitely could have opened a very different kind of restaurant and would have been in a much better place financially for everyone involved. But would we be having the like experience that guests have and the...
No, probably not.
No, and we have guests who come back once a month.
Because of that experience that you're projecting.
And is that right now? I mean, I personally know, and I think the whole staff, at least on the day-to-day basis, knows like that is worth more to me now as a business person than having a restaurant that puts a bunch of money in my pocket.
Yeah, I think it's most important to fight against what success means for most people, because I think it's entirely different for successful chefs. And I think, you know, I've done well in a lot of ways, but the most successful thing I can ever be is be, to me, the true definition of chef, which is I am a very good leader to the people I lead. That's it. That's enough. Success for me, right on the tombstone. You know, all the other things that will inevitably come your way are really nice accolades and things like that. They're not the definition of success. You know, a James Beard Award is not a defined success idea. It's a...
Well, it's like, because...
something to hang on a wall.
Yeah, and they all go different ways. Like, you could get Michelin stars and James Beard, and if that's your goal then that's great.
Yeah.
But you could also do that and then close a restaurant the next day.
Yep.
Like... And so it's really, that's where I think it's all a balance of like, you have these external, especially with those things and reviews and all this stuff that are external goals that I feel like everyone sort of has because it's put on you as like, these are things to aspire to, but you can get all those and people could still not come to your restaurant.
I forget who there was a restaurant recently who got a huge award, whether it was Michelin 3-star or 50 best or something like that, and then announced literally the next day that they're closing down.
Yeah.
And that's par for the course. It happens all the time. So your menu right now at Gem is, how many courses is it? It's right in front of me, but I'm not good at counting. Two,
it's four, tricky.
Six, eight, nine, big course, and then 10. So dessert, with dessert is 10. So
yes.
Give me the impetus and the idea behind the menu. Like, if a menu is a path, what's the path that you're going for?
So it changes a lot with the seasons. And I mean, this is something that I was also fascinated with opening a restaurant in New York, was like, the menu right now eats very different than a menu you would eat in July.
Right.
Because the ingredients that we're serving now are best in different ways. It's either we're trying to showcase the sweetness and freshness, but also intensity of shellfish and fish, and trying to extract as much flavor as we can get from these sort of leftover root vegetables that have been in a cellar for a few months. So this menu, I think it actually comes out, the way that it's served, it's 10 courses, but you actually get 19 servings. Throughout a lot of these courses, they're split into a few different things. And the food is smaller and there's more of it because we want to show the intensity in it. And in the summer, though, it's actually 10 courses and the food is bigger because, to me, I want in the summer a bowl of really delicious tomatoes and stone fruit and stuff. And the thing that we're trying to showcase in the entirety of the menu is its freshness.
Mm-hmm.
And freshness is really hard to understand, or like, the clean flavors and the very like crispness is really hard to understand in very small portions.
Right.
I've always thought this of like, you need to cook differently with that, because in the summer, if I give you one single slice of tomato, you get it, but you need enough of it to sort of coat your palate and to really have the impact because of how nuanced and you're trying to pick up all the very delicate flavors in it. opposed in the winter, we're serving something that's just going to like hit you in the face purposely.
Right. But your body's different in the summer than it is in winter. I mean, and I'm totally agreeing with you. I mean, I'm much more active in the summer. I want to play with those flavors in a bigger way. I don't just want one bite of those tomatoes. But
exactly.
My body's more hibernating and cold right now.
Yeah.
So, you know, your first course is a winter broth of roots and pine. So talk through that dish.
So that's something that it took me very long to figure out. Essentially, we wanted to take every root vegetable you can find at the market. And I've had a lot of personal difficulty with root vegetables because I didn't want it to be a menu that was just root vegetables. And I find the issue with them is when we try to extract the most amount of flavor out of them, we just get sweetness. And when you have a menu that if the bulk of our menu was focused around root vegetables, we'd have about 6 courses in the middle that all are just landing sweet, 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 yeah. Sweet, sweet.
Yeah.
It's really hard to extract anything else from those vegetables. So that's where I sort of thought of it in a very different way. I was like, we're not trying to extract the most intense flavors of it. We're trying to extract the sweetness in a very subtle way. So it's there's celery root, carrots, parsnips, sunchokes, sort of any...
And the goal of that is not to just really hypercook them to really extract all those sugars, but more to modulate the cooking
the broth? We grate all of the root vegetables at like that minute.
Yeah.
So you have the fresh, just grate, just kind of bruises them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's some dried apples and some pine needles and a few kind of spices in there. And we steep the whole thing for 20 minutes, and that's it.
It's like a tisane almost.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. And it's a very interesting thing. It took a really long time because if we strain it and push it,
like you'll extract a lot of sugar.
It's too sweet.
Yeah.
If we extract it for 15 minutes, it tastes like water.
Yeah.
But when you get that sort of perfect sweet spot, you get all of this sweetness of a tea that's very welcoming and a little bit of that like kind of spice from the pine almost. And it's this very just sort of comforting thing that is showcasing.
Is that astringent spice note of the pine? Do you think that that's going against any inherent sweetness in the broth?
It's supposed to. It's for the lingering because I tried it without the pine. It was very just like one note. It was like sweet. It was like a sweet.
Is it pure pine or is it like spruce tip? Or?
It's pure pine.
Okay.
It's white pine.
Yep.
And we tried with different kinds of pine, and it was a very long process to get it to be, because it is this thing where it's the only dish on the menu that has no seasoning, too, which was a tricky thing.
There's no salt in it.
There's no salt in it. It is just the vegetables and water, and that's it. And to do something that's that just simple is incredibly hard to have it hit right.
Yeah.
But it was meant of this way of just to like welcome you, and you're coming in from the cold and you want something warm and comforting. And I think really showcases like what the rest of the menu is like, we're taking these ingredients and not necessarily like extracting the flavor that comes out of it, but finding what we want in the ingredients to let it come out of it.
Yeah, but in select moderation.
Exactly.
And in smartly curating those flavors. It's like using matsutakis. It's like people want to use a lot of them, but it's like matsutake is such a pervasive flavor that it just needs, it's like you're saying, it needs a steeping for an X amount of time that's very brief to just, and because it's such a beautiful lingering flavor, but too much is like too much tarragon or something like that. It's really off-putting.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a really interesting idea of like, cuisine of moderate flavor, like of harnessing the flavor before it goes to the expectation of what people are used to when they talk about that flavor.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially because it's such a long menu too.
Yeah.
That we need to like formulate what flavors we're doing because it needs to flow. And like, that's something that I didn't realize for a while of like how important the flow of the menu is and how it's like, we're writing a whole menu. It's not, we're trying to put the 12 most delicious dishes we can do. It's they need to all work together in sync. And so that's why, like, there are root vegetable dishes that I loved that I made, but they just didn't work with the menu because they were extracting flavors that just...
But you're right. It's like on those winter menus, it's like cabbage, root. And it just can be really heavy-handed. I just had to write a menu for a dinner I have to do at this amazingly beautiful architectural place called Fogo Island Inn. Have you ever heard of that place?
No.
It's off the coast in a little tiny off of Newfoundland. And it is the most amazing inn owned by this woman. And but the whole emphasis of the dinner, they're really big into cellars there and old use of food and things like that. So this is all, this is the hotel.
Wow.
And it's all the, so in March in Newfoundland, it's called the Long Hungry Month.
Yeah.
Because you're at the tail end of the of your cellar.
Sorry, and all these very, make the dish.
Yeah, go ahead. They all have very elaborate cellars, so it's like literally like cooking the remnants of things and the remnants of root vegetables and yeah. remnants of potatoes and things like this. So, you know, but it's a challenge to run a menu based on these things because it's not like everybody's like, well, winter's so limiting. It's not. It just needs to push us in new direction
yeah.
on how to capture the flavors of winter that can really be presented.
And so. I mean, I honestly feel like we, like, as a restaurant, this is our second winter. Like, we opened in winter.
Yeah.
And don't think we got it right the first time. Like, we focused too hard on the root vegetables and too much on that sort of traditional form that we went with throughout the whole year of start with like raw fish and whatever, move into vegetable courses, then move in, finish with like a main protein, then dessert. And with this one, kind of realized that that didn't really work with, it needed to be more all over the place to hit the proper sort of crescendo of a menu into that final savory course. Which is that our menu is always sort of focused around this final feast.
Right. And the feast right now is a seafood feast. I'm looking at it. It says grilled monkfish with XO, monkfish liver and cucumber skewer, chicken wings stuffed with fish sausage, cabbage and fish collar sandwich, and a chawan mushi with mustard. So that's all presented almost family style.
So yeah, you get chair plate, chopsticks.
Yep.
We bring it in waves. So at first you get the monkfish and the monkfish liver and the sandwich. Kind of have a minute to eat that, and then we bring the chawan mushi, which we take all the fish bones, roast them, make chawan mushi with that, and then there's some sautéed mustard greens on top, and finish sort of with the little, it's a chicken wing that we debone and stuff with a seafood sausage and glaze it in like a pine chicken reduction,
mm-hmm.
Which is sort of the final, most savory part of that course. And in the past, I mean, it's been, we've tried vegetable feasts. We've done a lot of different meats where we serve the entire animal and we try to honor the whole thing and show the, essentially it's always meant to showcase the, how far you can go with an ingredient.
Right.
How wide ranging it is. And so this, I was like, what do I love about cooked fish? Because I don't really like cooked fish. My favorite way to eat fish
is raw.
Is raw. Because yeah. You're showcasing the freshness, the deliciousness. And so that's why we chose fish that were high fat or like meant to be eaten. Like, you don't want to eat monkfish raw.
Nope.
And so what can we showcase out of that is that sort of meaty texture. So we're going to put it with sausage and dried fish and that really intense flavor. And then the fattiness of fish collars and how we pre-cook them and shred them and glaze them in this really, really intense.
And that's all monkfish collar on that?
No, those are yellowtail collars. Okay. So we used a few different kinds of fish.
Yep.
Because like in the sausage, we tried to make a sausage with monkfish. It was gross. So we used fluke for that. And so it definitely uses a few different kinds of fish. And we wanted to, ideally we could use one certain kind, but monkfish collars aren't good.
No.
They're not good. They don't have that same flaky, delicate, fatty texture. Speaking of, so this is the sandwich. So just dried cabbage leaves. Then there's some roasted cabbage. We make a glaze with dried shiitake mushrooms that we cook down really, really intensely. And then we take those mushrooms and marinate them in a little bit of dashi
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of vinegar. And then the fish itself is glazed with like really reduced mushroom farro glaze.
Okay. Now... So you're in a interesting generational time for being a chef. Luckily, around the time you were probably born, chefs started learning how to cook vegetables. Because I don't think they had known how to before, except in France, and they did them one way pretty much. It was all al dente, whatever, asparagus and things like that. Outside of barigoule and a couple of other variations. But it's like, so I'm looking at very beautiful crisp cabbage as the sort of sandwich bread of it. I just think we've come so far as chefs that we didn't stop, that we learned somehow to do this better, mostly when it comes to vegetables. And I still think that was a direct relation to the increasing cost of proteins and having to sell something. But yeah, this is the cabbage looks awesome. I'm gonna double it.
Double it.
So how is the collar cooked?
So we grill it. Whole with the skin on, peel the skin off, separate the individual pieces, and then essentially on the pickup, we glaze it in the reduced mushroom juice that's infused with toasted farro.
Okay.
And then just kind of reheat it very lightly.
What do you think the toasted farro does to the glaze?
It rounds out the glaze a little bit, because otherwise it just kind of tastes like really intense mushroom, and the toasted farro gives it that caramelization in the glaze and thickens it a little bit too. So it actually,
that's just because of the starch emanating from
the farro. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's great. That's awesome.
Thank you.
So I love this idea that, you know, this is the second winter menu, and the first one though was a success. It wasn't a complete success to you. And that goes to sort of the biggest pride I have in being a chef is being given a vocation where the best trait you can ever have is the want of endless learning, to never fully condition yourself as an expert, but rather a learner, and by to see progress always, that you never stand in one place. And that's, to me, it's like, if you've got that at such a young age, it's like, that's the key to happiness in this industry, is to just always be learning more about whatever it is. So.
Yeah. So this is the other. This is just how we start the menu. So it's this, and then usually they get a little salad of citrus on the side. But so this was, we got these beautiful scallops from the Peconic Bay, and from this really crazy fisherman. And it was just this, we get them very odd times. And I've always hated, because I worked a lot in Scandinavia, where the scallop shells are ridged and beautiful, and the scallops that you get in Maine, or just like the whole ones, have such ugly kind of shells when you serve it in the shell. So we took these little bay scallops with the most beautiful shells, and so we made I wanted to showcase the both things I love about scallops, which is the freshness, but also like a roasted scallop in butter is so delicious. So we made a scallop butter, made a shortbread with the scallop butter, cooked it inside the shell, between two shells, so it looks like the shell. Then underneath it laid, there's a paste that's scallops that are blended raw with miso and koji water and some potato starch and reduced into a paste, and some raw scallops, a little yuzu kosho and lime quats. So it has the brightness on the top, and then you get the two bottom layers that are really intense scallop.
What do you think about, and now I'm eating it, and it's amazing. Are you making your own misos and stuff?
Yeah, we're fermenting our own koji. Have not had enough time to make misos yet, but
which is always an interesting thing in chefdom, on where you draw the line on what you should be making from scratch. I'm a firm believer in almost everything, but then again, am I insulting a person who's made miso for generationally in a family that's been making it 600 years?
Yeah, we work with this woman who imports very specific things from Japan that I don't know if the FDA is okay with it, because they come in like plastic bags,
and we won't tell them.
Probably brings them herself, and we got this. We only use this one. It's barley miso, and I tried it, and unlike any miso I've ever had, and I was like, I confidently know, like, we can try, and like we can, and that's, we do try. But until the point at which we can make a miso that tastes that good, we're going to keep buying that.
There's a difference between, I mean, we can all make really good fresh cheese, right?
Yeah.
And but that's an instantaneous activation, a separation, a process. You know, but then people, you know, in the 90s were all making their own mozzarella and stuff like this. And I was always like, You know, I mean, you can buy some mozzarella. This guy's been making it for every day for his entire life, and it's transcendently good.
Yeah.
And the ones that I'd always make where they're making it themselves was just never the same. So, I don't know. There's an interesting line there. It's like, you know, you wouldn't expect fine dining restaurants to make their own wine.
Yeah.
And so why do we expect?
Yeah. And I think that comes with the whole thing where you kind of have to, there's a point at which you have to look and be like, I'm not perfect at everything.
Right. Right.
There are people like we do this all with like, if we want to use sourdough in something,
mm-hmm.
we just physically don't have the space or the staffing or the oven to make a perfect sourdough. But we work with a bakery that has all of that.
You live in New York. You can find anything.
And that's where it's like, there's some things where it's like, you just are going to get a better quality. And like, that's where it's, I think we talk about this all the time in service and food and everything of like, what are you doing for yourself or for the guest?
Yep.
And
that's a really good point, which is something that I've experienced a lot lately with a certain generation right now of chefs is I would just want to make sure that you are cooking for the guest as well. You are cooking to apply happiness to that person.
Exactly.
You are not cooking to compete with yourself, to challenge yourself. That can be part of it.
Yeah.
But if that's the overwhelming reason you're doing it, then it's not right.
You need to know when to stop yourself.
Yes.
Because it's like, yes, initially everything comes with this yourself because mm-hmm. you're cooking it for yourself and trying it yourself. And there's been many times where I put a dish on the menu that I love and
it just doesn't.
It doesn't work in the dining room, and we take it off because.
But that needs to be an honest, mature assessment of what we're doing. Yeah. We're also in business.
Yeah, hospitality.
The business of cooking for myself is probably not very good because I ate a lot of really simple salads. Yeah. I mean, it's done Sweetgreen well, but you know,
it's not gonna make it's not gonna do anything good for you.
No,
and that's where even like with buying ingredients, it's like, okay, are we gonna make this bread, this sourdough, or whatever, that is for us to like have this sort of self thing of like we made everything and it's not the best quality the guest can get, or are we going to say we work with this incredible company and showcase them too.
Showcase a relationship.
And, and the guest is going to go, this is incredible.
Yeah.
And they're going to eat it and it's delicious and we're not going to serve it. I mean, like we think about that with fish, with everything. We're not going to serve it unless it's the best. So why would we make something that we're not good at?
I mean, also we're not often equipped to do the work that they can do. We don't have the space, as you said, but you know, I've got a friend of mine who has a bakery in Atlanta called Root Baking, and Chris Wilkins is the baker's name and the owner of the bakery. He knows more about bread than I will ever know. If I started learning more about bread every day, I would still never know as much as Chris does. Chris also has a, you know, $75,000 mill, and he buys these amazing grains from around the country, mills everything himself per order, per day. And I just don't have those facilities. Yeah. I don't have the intellect for that. I don't have
the time.
Dive. And I also respect Chris's intellectual and technical skills with bread. And I want to pay homage to that and let more people know about it. So, you know, it's exactly the same thing as talking about a winemaker you adore for the wines they make and learning the narrative and the story about that. To me, I find it's more exciting for guest engagement than saying we made this sourdough ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah. So there's a documentary coming out called Chef Flynn, which I think is probably about you.
Yes.
So you want to talk about
mostly.
That? Mostly.
Yeah. This documentarian, his name's Cameron Yates, essentially reached out to my family like when I was 13 or 14, or when I was 13. I was like, I want to make a documentary about you guys. And we said no. And then, but we really liked the guy. And so we became friends with him, started going to dinner. He lived in New York when we were in LA. And about a year later, just we're sort of like, yeah, you can film a dinner. And then that created sort of the relationship. He ended up filming me for 6 years, or 5 years, and then like a year of editing.
Did he film the first pop-up in New York?
He filmed the first pop-up in New York.
Good.
That's in it. It Going Wrong. Yeah.
Okay.
That's like the point in the movie that... don't want to give too much away, but you see everything go down and all of that. And then it also is my mom's a filmmaker and made all these videos of me when I was little and cooking. So it essentially has my life from 1 until 18. It was one of those funny things where it went to Sundance like 3 weeks before the restaurant opened. And so it was a crazy like double like restaurant opening and that happening at the exact same time. And I think I've seen it twice. I can't watch it any more than twice.
Right.
But, I think it, to me, I really enjoyed it because it, I think there's been a lot of misread things, whatever, where people have written about things. I mean, with anything in the world where it's like someone says something that's not true and then it gets conflated and keeps going and going and going. And this was someone who spent 6 years with us and showed everything the way that it actually happened.
Right. Right.
And understands that it is also a work in progress of like, he's not showing, like, he didn't show the restaurant opening for a reason.
Right.
We're showing a period of this person's life.
Yeah.
And like, he's going to go do his thing and like, we're not going to be intrusive into that and doing it in a showy way. It's just sort of being like, this is a story about me, but also mostly about the amount of people around me that helped make everything happen.
Yeah. I mean, how was it with the pressure of like, I mean, a lot of that was just like weird media that was written about you about, you know, I mean, which happens to any prodigious person, but it just, to me, you always just seemed like this, like hyper mature kid who just had a really big thing for food and chefdom and wanted to do it since a young age.
And that was it.
And to me, I mean, to me, I always like shrugged like, hey, I don't know. I think that's cool.
Yeah. And I mean, it is a funny thing. That's how I've always ever thought about it, where I was just like, I've always liked cooking, and if I get opportunities to do it, I'm gonna do it.
Great. I've got a 16-year-old daughter who's wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon since she was 5 years old, and when she first told me, I was like, what is that, Beatrice? I mean, she still wants to be that, and it's what she'll do.
That's way better than having your kid want to be a chef then.
Yeah, it's probably more profitable.
Yes, but, for sure.
I think you dealt with all that, which could have been frustrating to a lot of people and been anxiety prone to a lot of people. Like just the I don't know,
the constant thing of it was, I think, a lot at first.
Yeah.
But then the constant thing sort of becomes comforting in a weird way.
Yeah. And like, you learn to sort of recess back.
You know that it's always going to happen and it's always going to be there. And like, I mean, I think I've always had the thing where I was like, this is all I've ever wanted to do is have a restaurant.
Yeah.
And regardless of all of that stuff, I did it. And like, that was the thing that got me through all that too, where I was just like, I don't really care what's going on in an external way. Like, I just want to continue cooking.
Yeah.
And got enough opportunities and enough people who supported me and were behind me that it could happen.
To do it successfully.
And so, yeah. I mean, that's where I think it's a lot of like the amount of attention you give anything of like, I gave all my attention to what I was doing, not the reactions that people who had never eaten the food or had never met me were having to it, because that just seems like such a waste of time.
You weren't like a 1980s young TV star who's now gone through some crazy addiction issue. I think you're okay.
Yeah, it's the thing where it's like you could sit all day worrying about the fact that like the world could like explode tomorrow, and you could put your attention in that way. Yeah. And it's like, I've always believed it's like, if you put your work and attention in a positive thing or whatever you want to put that into, you're going to do it. I could have put all my attention into that.
Yeah.
And I would have become depressed or whatever from this thing and been sort of stopped what I loved doing because my focus shifted to the negative of it. But my focus just always stayed on like, I want to learn the most and be as good of a chef as I can be and serve people food.
And you're outwardly not done with that.
No.
You're enjoying it.
And I mean,
it's a process.
It's, and like, that's why I keep enjoying it, because it's such a long process.
It is
of
a
like,
long process.
It's never going to be done.
No, you're never done with
it. It's never going to be done.
But that's the enjoyment of it, is that constant learning. And but you know, I think that, you know, you're in the Lower East Side. We've talked about Jeremiah and Fabian over at Wild Air and Contra. I mean, you've got great supporters and mentors who are young and have been through it too.
Yeah.
At your disposal.
That's friends
and guiders. And so, but that's the key in this industry, is you need to find those people who you really, and you already have, who are going to always support your ideas and your decisions, but also guide you when you want the guidance. And you know, they're good backbone.
Yeah, I mean, and
because the chefdom is such a fucking weird, egotistical bastion of shit that it's so nice to find people who are just doing it for all the right reasons.
Yeah,
and I
also think there is something to it where it's like, especially in this sect of it, it's like, I understand I'm not making millions of dollars from this. Like, that's not what I want to get out of it.
And
And so there is something about like those days where you're slow, or where the satisfaction of guests enjoying it, or the satisfaction of having a great night of service, whatever, where when all that boils down, it is a community.
Yeah.
And like the community's been trying, like going away and going away and going away as it's become more cutthroat in this way that is very sort of aggressive. I mean, one of my favorite, the chef from Frenchette that just opened in New York, his name's Riyadh.
Yeah.
Who's been in...
He used to be a Balthazar for years.
Forever.
The Nasser's, yep.
He lives next door to the restaurant. He used to come in when we did a coffee shop. And I think he's one of the only people in New York who truly has not a bad word to say about anyone. He's like, anyone doing something that they're passionate about is creating, is just pushing the industry to a greater good. And why would we not support that?
Yep.
If they're doing it passionately and for all the right reasons...
And he's a badass.
Yeah. And it's like,
his food is so good.
Yeah, but I mean, it just like that mentality of like, regardless of who they are, where they came from, how much like work they put into it, as long as they're doing it for the right reasons and adding something good to the food scene, support it.
Yeah.
Because they're dealing with the same shit you're dealing with.
How about just the bottom line being, as long as they're just good people.
Yeah.
Period. Let's just support good people.
And put in the work.
Put in the work.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Nobody was born with a silver spoon. So it's, do the work and be optimistic about the industry, and but be a good member of this community. So it's not that hard.
Say hi to people, be nice to them. Yeah. It's not that hard.
Be authentic. I think that's what you've got in droves. So we're not worried about you. But welcome to call me if you need any advice. I don't really have that much. Flynn, it's been great to chat.
Yeah.
It's an awesome restaurant.
Thanks for dropping in.
You're an awesome human. And we will look forward to Chef Flynn, the documentary. And I will let you get ready for service.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Cheers. This week's episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped by Brian Blum on location at Gem Restaurant in Lower Manhattan. It's the Lower East Side. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mazzell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate and review and come back Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram @HughAtchison. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Be swell.